From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Ambassador Stavros Lambrinidis, former Minister of Foreign Affairs to Greece, now European Union Ambassador to the United States. Our topic, how Russia's latest invasion of Ukraine is changing the shape of Europe and affecting the transatlantic alliance. Instead of weakening and dividing the European Union, Moscow's February 24th invasion of Ukraine has strengthened it. Ukraine, whose sovereignty and independence was violated by Russia in 2014 and now in 2022, has submitted its application for EU membership. Traditionally neutral Finland and Sweden, both EU members, are now on the verge of joining the NATO alliance as a hedge against Russian aggression. Other past developments precipitated by Russia's brutal attack on Ukraine include Germany's intent to wean the country from its dependence on Russian oil and gas, including the suspension of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, and provide lethal weapons to Ukraine. Worried that Russian President Vladimir Putin was bent on the revanchist, turning back the clock to when Moscow controlled half of Europe, the EU bloc has imposed punishing sanctions on Russia, sent military equipment and humanitarian aid to Ukraine, and has a plan to drastically reduce its reliance on Russian energy sources by the end of 2022. We will also talk with Ambassador Stavros Lambrinidis about the EU's short and long-term response to efforts by Moscow to falsely blame the EU and the United States for threatening Russia, when in fact, it is Vladimir Putin's Russia which is violating the post-World War II liberal international order by trying to redraw boundaries through force and recreate the Soviet Union. Ambassador Stavros Lambrinidis joins us via Skype. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Mr. Ambassador, there has been extraordinary unity among EU members, with an exception here and there regarding Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine in February. And as you know, the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, they've been warning the EU about a revanchist Russia, you know, even before Moscow's 2014 annexation of Crimea and destabilization of the Donbass, some of which is now under its control. Mr. Ambassador, give us a status update on the EU's latest strategy to support Ukraine and why it is so important to do so.
It's very important to do so because Putin is, I'm afraid, trying to kill many birds with one stone, literally kill Ukrainians on the ground and wipe off the map an independent country, but also kill the international peace architecture that we all set together around the world after World War II, that is based on the freedom of people to choose, the respect for borders, fundamentally the principles that might is not right and that international law should apply. And if Mr. Putin were to achieve his goals, then you would have instability all over the world, where many countries, big neighbors with bigger guns than the neighbor next to them, would feel entitled to demand from the neighbors things, and if they didn't get them, then to threaten them and to actually invade them. That would be a world that no one wants to see, whether they're in Europe, where the threat is existential to us, or in Africa, Latin America, Asia, anywhere else. So that is why you see European unity and strength. What is our strategy, you ask? We have immediately decided that we have to impose massive costs on Mr. Putin and on the Kremlin to ensure that they feel the pain of their invasion, both now but also in the future if they don't stop now, if they don't return to the UN Charter and respect for international law. And these are sanctions that cover a vast area of things, but they do not cover food exports or fertilizer exports, because there is a food crisis created as well by Russia's invasion, by its deliberate military tactics of bombing fields, of bombing agricultural equipment, of bombing storage, and of course, preventing trade of agricultural commodities in the Black Sea that they have declared as a war zone, the whole thing, making it impossible, extremely costly for shippers and others to take that out. So our second goal is to ensure that we work with the rest of the world to ensure that the terrible consequences of Russia's invasion, including on energy prices and on food, are mitigated as much as we can, both in our own borders, but also in other countries, especially in Africa. Our third goal is to make sure that there is a resolution to this dispute that fully respects the Ukrainian independence and territorial integrity, and certainly comes through negotiations, one would hope. But for that to happen, Russia has to be serious about negotiations, and we haven't seen the slightest interest of Russia or serious about this. So the Ukrainians have to be able to be strong on the battlefield, as they have been forced in a deadly war by their big might is right neighbors. And so we are supporting Ukraine as much as we can with military equipment, including lethal military equipment, to ensure that it can fight back the Russian army. We also have a longer-term vision for Ukraine, which is, frankly, the vision of Ukrainian citizens themselves. They do not want war. They do not want destruction. They do not want famine. They do not want 8 million of their people displaced outside their country. Children, women mostly, they want peace and they want a European perspective based on prosperity and based on freedom and openness and democracy. That's what they've chosen for themselves. They were punished, quote unquote, by Russia for this in 2014, and they are being massively threatened with extinction today again by Russia for those aspirations. That is unacceptable. So we as Europeans have given European candidate status to Ukraine, and we will be working very hard with the country, including through helping it reconstruct after this terrible, brutal war, to be able to reach a point to be a full member of the European family.
Well, thank you for that important explanation. And Mr. Ambassador, as we all know, the longer this war goes on, it is testing the resolve of Ukraine's Western allies, including the United States and the EU. So I guess the question is, do you think the punishing sanctions on Russia that both the United States and the EU have imposed, and the military hardware and other humanitarian aid that you're providing to Ukraine, do you think that that is having an effect in terms of turning the tide of the war? We are seeing the Russians sort of on the upswing, whereas Ukraine was dominant in the beginning. This is going to test also the public opinion of EU members. Do you have the political will, do you think, to stay the course?
Well, the short answer is yes, because this Russian violation of international law is existential for us in the European Union. Keep in mind that the European Union was created after the Second World War. We came out of the bloodiest war of the 20th century that was committed in the hands of Europeans themselves. And we decided after that war that we would unite to ensure that never again would we Europeans have either the desire or the capacity to inflict such terrible carnage on each other or on anyone else in the world. The European Union is the ultimate peace project. And what Russia is doing now is trying to trample all the foundations that the EU was built on. And it openly says that it is trying to do this. It openly says that it is trying to bring back the power of guns as a determinant of international relations, both in Europe and around the world. So, yes, it is costly to be imposing sanctions, to be facing high energy prices, etc., etc. But there's a price to pay for freedom, and the Europeans have proven from day one that they are more than willing to pay that price and to stop Mr. Putin. I think if anyone was surprised by the European strength and unity, that was Mr. Putin, probably more than anyone else. I bet you he was gambling that at least one or two European member states out of the 27 might not agree on the massive sanctions that have been imposed on him, and not a single EU member state, in spite of all the rumors about divisions and stuff like that, which I get on virtually every crisis that hits Europe in the past decades, every single prime minister and president signed on those sanctions. And I underline, if you were to compare it to a country like the United States, where you need a single president to sign on to sanctions, and that's it, in Europe you do need unanimity, and you had it. And you had it not on one set of sanctions, but on six sections of sanctions, including on massive decisions that have to do with decoupling Europe entirely from its reliance on Russian gas and oil. And I say these are massive because our reliance today is extremely high. And yet we are diversifying as we speak. So the sanctions are not, and were never intended to be, a magic bullet. But the fact of the matter is, without the sanctions, Mr. Putin today would be having his cake and eating it too. And what the sanctions are achieving, in addition to immediate hurt to the Russian economy and mostly the inner circle of corrupt oligarchs, including Mr. Putin himself, what they're achieving is a very massive deterioration of the capacity of the Russian economy to adjust to the 21st century. Mr. Putin today and tomorrow will have to face a different dilemma. It's not going to be having your cake and eating it too. That would be very nice. It's going to be choosing between butter and guns for his own people. And I believe that his legacy, if he continues down this treacherous path, is going to be exactly that. A leader who has taken a proud country and has thrown it in a bloody war with tens of thousands of Russian soldiers dead already, and more to come, obviously, if the war keeps going on, with the Russian economy hit at its most sensitive areas, and with probably a Russia not only diminished in the world in terms of a statue, having become already an international pariah, but also, and I'm guessing that was probably not among Mr. Putin's calculations, a Russia that is depending much more on the desire to support it of other countries, countries that it would not normally, as a proud Russia, want to be a puppet of. So in the end of the day, do not doubt European resilience. I know that Mr. Putin hopes that we will at some point get tired, but we haven't and we won't. This is existential. But also do not doubt the ability of countries around the world to unite against Mr. Putin. Listen, this is not a war of the West against Russia. This is a war and a fight of the West and the East, of the North and the South, in support of Ukraine, in support of the fundamental principles of the UN Charter, in support of the rights of people to determine freely their destinies around the world. This is what this is about. And this is why I think that as I sit here in Washington, it may appear that this is a war somewhere on the other side of the Atlantic. Well, there's no safe distance when an autocrat, especially one sitting on nuclear weapons, decides that he wants to try to bend the will of free nations and free people to his own. And because there's no safe distance, I have no doubt that the coalition that we have built with the sanctions, with the outreach to countries around the world to support them with the food security and energy crises, that coalition will prevail.
Ambassador Lambrinidis, there's no question that the EU has demonstrated uncharacteristic speed and unity with respect to sanctions on Russia. But as you said, many countries depend on Russian crude. Give us a sense of where things stand with respect to an eventual oil embargo. Are there any differences or rifts within the EU? We know that Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban is sort of holding out, and he is quite a buddy, one could say, of Putin, notwithstanding his membership in the EU. Give us a sense of where things stand with regard to the oil embargo.
I'm glad you're asking this question because, in fact, it was recently in the sixth package of sanctions that we decided unanimously as Europeans that we included an oil embargo on Russian imports. About 90% of all Russian imports by early 2023 will be not coming into the EU anymore. Now, there was a discussion, and of course there always is in the European Union, among our member states, to ensure the best way to bring the hurt that we need to bring on Russia for this brutality without having the sanctions harming us more than they harm Russia. And we do have some member states in the EU that are landlocked, that do not have the capacity or the possibility to get oil through sea lanes that easily. And in this case, we decided that we would have transition periods and also exclude for a while 10% of those imports from the full oil sanctions to make sure that those countries would not be excessively disadvantaged. You must know, and people listening us should know, that the European Union and its member states rely on different levels on Russian or other energy imports. Some massively produce renewable energy themselves and rely mostly on their homegrown energy. Others import some gas and oil from Russia, but also from other sources. And there are others that have been historically almost entirely dependent on Russian gas and oil. So given those differences, we want to make sure, and we have made sure, that we are embargoing the import of Russian oil, but we're doing so in the way that we can reduce the disruptions in the global market as much as possible, and also ensure that all our member states can be protected in this process.
We'll take a short break. We'll be right back. You are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Ambassador Stavros Lambrinidis, European Union Ambassador to the United States. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voaafrica.com/PCUSA. Or you may listen on one of your favorite podcast apps. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. We're speaking with Ambassador Stavros Lambrinidis, the EU ambassador to the United States. Back to you, Ambassador Lambrinidis. What about the long run in terms of fast-tracking Ukraine's EU membership? Where does that stand?
So the 27 European leaders in the end of June made a unanimous decision to offer full European Union candidate status to Ukraine. That means that the process now will be kicking off and the negotiations, as with every other member state, will commence. To understand, the European Union is not a social club. It's a major economic and values superpower in the world. And therefore, every country that comes into the European Union has to make changes to ensure that its laws are aligned with the European Union laws that all other member states apply. This is something that may sound easy or may sound difficult. I'm not sure, depending on those listening, how much into the weeds they get in those things. But in fact, it is very difficult. Every one of our member states has to make dramatic changes to ensure then that they can enter the single market. And that means changes in the way that their economy works. And so we have committed with Ukraine, the European Union, to be leading the support to them on their reconstruction, even now during the war, but certainly after it. There are going to be hundreds of billions of euros are going to be necessary for this, but to ensure that that reconstruction happens in a way that brings Ukraine into the EU as fast as possible. So an emphasis on green investments and green growth and sustainable development, an emphasis on digital and high-tech investments are going to be huge for the economic growth and the employment in the European Union in the next few years, but also for things like sustainable agriculture. And Ukraine, of course, is one of the huge agricultural baskets of the world. How to be able to produce more and to produce better. Already, before even Ukraine is in the EU, in the past few years, we have an association agreement with Ukraine. And if you look at the dramatic changes that have happened in the Ukrainian society and economy, you can see the perspective of the European Union membership being already extremely effective. The Ukrainian electricity grid was 100% tied into the Russian one. In lightning speed, during this war, we switched it. And now it's entirely tied into the European one. And that gives the Ukrainians both the strength of the European electricity grid, the security of it, but also the capacity to be exporting massively some of their energy to Europe. If you look at reforms in the country, Ukraine is the only country that has right now an anti-oligarch, anti-corruption law. The implementation of this law, though, is going to be extremely important, because indeed the Ukrainians have recognized that that kind of corruption has been quite endemic in the system for many decades. As opposed to countries like Russia, they have determined that they want to root it out. And that also is going to take a tremendous amount of reforms, including judicial reforms and things like that. But again, Ukraine is on the path with European support. So this is not I press a button and someone is a member the next day. It is a process, but it's a very hopeful process, a process that is going to be giving benefits to the Ukrainian people as it goes forward, even before they become full members. And it's a process that Europeans are committed to, because the Ukrainian people have said that they want to be a part of the European family. The Ukrainian people are fighting and dying today, supporting world values, universal values, and European values of freedom and of democracy. And we are going to make sure that we're going to be next to them every step of the way.
Ambassador Lambrinidis, you said before that, of course, Russia is also attacking food storage facilities, and we know that they are bombarding cities even far from the war front. There are so many civilian casualties. One could characterize these as war crimes. Two questions. One, with respect to Russia's invasion as it relates to global food security, what are some of the measures you are taking to ensure that this type of destabilization cannot continue? What kind of consequences will there be for Moscow, for the Kremlin, for engaging in these tactics which really violate the laws of war?
Well, the International Criminal Court has already engaged in investigating those crimes. And we, the European Union, together with the UK and others, are supporting the Ukrainian prosecutors on the ground to be able to collect in the most effective way that evidence. Because those prosecutions are based on evidence. They're not based on disinformation. They're not based on every other tactic that Russia and others, I'm afraid, supporting it. Not that many, but those who are supporting it have been engaged in, but on facts. You know, there are Russian officials who are openly admitting on Russian TV that creating a food crisis is one of Russia's strategic war aims. They say that maybe if the rest of the world understands how terrible the consequences can be on them of this war being prolonged and how much they need Russia to be nice in Ukraine with food, that maybe they will start siding with Russia. It is chilling to hear them say this. These are the Russian Hunger Games, and we have to stop those Hunger Games. They will not blackmail the world. And they're going out with a disinformation narrative that concerns me more than anything else, that somehow it is the sanctions imposed on Russia that are creating the food security crisis. Now, this is so absurd that perhaps because it's so absurd, it is possible for some people to say, well, it cannot be. I mean, if it sounds so crazy, maybe there's something to it. It is absolutely not true. It is Russia's war that has managed to eliminate Ukraine's capacity to export. Ukrainian exports constituted the vast majority of exports for a number of African and other countries. And when Ukraine gets bombed and its food supplies get intentionally targeted, and when companies are not allowed in the Black Sea to take that grain out, and when Russia, in fact, to make it even worse and even more hair-raising, in my view, steals a lot of that Ukrainian grain to exporting it itself, you have a situation in your hands where there is no question that this is a man-made crisis, and that man has a name, and that name is Putin. Now, at the same time, we have ensured that our sanctions do not touch, that's openly stated, the capacity of Ukraine or Russia to export food all over the world. It does not touch the capacity to export fertilizers all over the world. And in fact, what we're seeing in Russia is that, forgetting for a second Ukraine's grains, Russia itself has been limiting its exports to the rest of the world of food or imposing massive tariffs to them so they become very expensive. It's part of this deliberate plan to create a food crisis, to create hunger games. But we've also told our friends in Africa, for example, the European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, last month sent a letter to all his counterparts in Africa. We have said, please let us know, in the event that you are suffering directly those insecurities, food insecurity and crisis, let us know if you have identified any part of that crisis related to the sanctions. Maybe some shippers are overcompensating, afraid to get involved because they're not sure that they can export those grains when in fact they can. Let us know. We have not, up to now, received a single letter back or communication to embassies indicating that the reason that food security is happening in Africa is because of the sanctions, when we ask for specific examples, and we understand this. But in addition to all this, we're giving direct aid now to Africa, billions of euros to countries in North Africa, in the Sahel, in the Horn, to make sure that they can face the immediate crises. And we are doing so also to make sure we can support their own farmers. Sometimes if you actually bring food in, that is good because food comes in a country, but that is terrible for the farmers of the country who suddenly cannot sell what they are producing internally. So we are instead supporting financially those countries to be able, through their farmers as well, and of course through all the food aid programs, to be able to ameliorate this problem. We are working very hard to create storage capacities for Ukrainian grain, because about 20,000 tons of that grain, 20 million tons of that grain today, are stuck in storage facilities in Ukraine because of Russia's invasion, and they can rot. And as the Ukrainian farmers are planting now for the next harvest, they will not have where to put that harvest, and that will create even more problems. So this is cynical Russia, but we are doing everything we can to stop it. And finally, we're also using what we call solidarity lanes, increasing as much as we can the capacity of Ukraine to export some of those grains through the European Union, as opposed to the fact that they were up to now exporting them exclusively through Odessa, mostly in the Black Sea. But in the end of the day, Odessa has to be able to allow to export grains. The Russians have to stop playing the hunger games and make sure that the negotiations going on also with the United Nations bear results, and we're supporting that process as well. So it's a very complex picture, but it's clear why the storm was created. And the rest of the world has to be clear as well. Mr. Putin, stop your deadly, illegal, brutal attempt to wipe Ukraine and its people off the map. Stop your war. And in the process, stop all the terrible consequences that you are deliberately causing through that war.
In the very few minutes we have left, you are very eloquent in your description of what's at stake in this war. The free world is dealing with a ruthless authoritarian. And yet, as you said, the disinformation campaign, it's a gaslighting campaign, somehow blaming everything on the West, the sanctions, when in fact, of course, he did invade Ukraine, a sovereign country. something that hasn't happened since, you know, World War II in Europe. As we close, anything else you would like to add with respect to the refugee crisis? And once again, we're talking about a test of wills. And notwithstanding the enormous efforts that the EU is making, the United States, the entire transatlantic alliance, you know, we are dealing with a ruthless dictator who doesn't tell the truth to his own people, who have been propagandized. They clearly don't know or can't find out what really is going on. You have China, you know, the autocratic alliance versus the free world. Do we have the political will to see this through? And, you know, is President Volodymyr Zelensky, what kind of feedback are you getting from him in terms of the kind of support he wants? Is he relatively satisfied with the kind of support he's getting?
The Ukrainians are extremely satisfied and grateful for the support they've gotten from the EU and the United States and others. But of course, they keep emphasizing that they need more sophisticated weaponry, especially as the fighting conditions in the plains of the Donbas are different from the fighting conditions when it came to the Russians initially trying and hoping that they would be able to take over Kiev and overthrow the government and take over the country in a matter of days. And there you need different kind of military equipment. So he has been making this point. When it comes to disinformation, it's not just food security, of course. It is the attempt to demonize the Ukrainian people themselves as irrelevant and non-existent that Mr. Putin began from the beginning, saying that they had no right to exist to begin with, and that he would just try to take that part back because it's his, claiming amazingly that he is going to denazify, quote-unquote.
Right.
When, in fact, Mr. Zelensky happens to be Jewish, when the extreme right, because of course there are extreme right Nazi sympathizing parties in virtually every country in the world. The extreme right in the last elections got about, 5% of the vote, 4% of the vote, something like that. I mean, boy, if the Ukrainians are Nazis, they have a fantastic way to hide the ball on this because, you know, every indication is that this is just a horrific authoritarian Putin attempt to hide his own massive violation of law and human dignity behind such a rhetoric. But that has fallen apart, including a place like Mariupol, where there were so many Russian speakers, and his troops went there and simply bombed and destroyed the city because they couldn't take it over without doing so, killing so many Russian speakers, among others, who he claims he's conducting this war to protect. I mean, this is dystopian. And we are talking to countries, you mentioned China, we are talking to countries like China, and we are passing some very clear messages. Any major country in the world that wants to consider itself an international player has to respect international law and the UN system. They cannot be sitting on the fence and acting like this is, you know, a neutral dispute, because it isn't. It was an individual decision of a particular president to invade and destroy a country he didn't like. He was never threatened by NATO, as he claimed. In fact, there were virtually no NATO troops in all the EU, the new NATO member states adjoining Russia, until now, when in fact everyone understands that he's such a danger that there's no way that we can afford not protecting militarily as well everybody's borders with Russia. So he has plunged into this, creating this chaos. And we told China, look, you cannot sit on the fence here. You have to use your influence on Mr. Putin, and you have to do it to make sure that he immediately allows food to leave Ukraine. You have to make sure, because the rest of the world cannot sit back and suffer and have a country like China play Mr. Putin's game. You and anyone else should not in any way be attempting to override sanctions and to give a lifeline to Mr. Putin in these circumstances. So we are having a lot of discussions around the world, and we are doing it again, I emphasize, because this is a fight of everyone, north, south, east, and west, to protect international law and dignity and the human dignity of any peoples in any country in the world. It is not a fight of the West versus Russia or the West versus anyone else. And many countries in the world understand this. So if we all, as we have up to now, work together to stop this brutality, I am very optimistic in the end of the day that we will come out of this unprecedented crisis stronger and more united, and I hope more peaceful.
Ambassador Stavros Lambrinidis is the EU ambassador to the United States. He joined us via Skype. Ambassador Lambrinidis, thank you for your time. and your eloquent insights. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.